y'all. This is Josh recording live from the Queen of Disco City, Donna Summer.
Yo, what's good? This is Jesse reporting from Oakland, California.
What's up, everyone? This is Michael in Boston, Massachusetts. And our brother Marvin could not join us today, but we are here with him in spirit. And welcome to another episode of the Melanated Social Work Podcast. We have a very special guest, a Buddhist minister, author, activist, yoga instructor, and authorized Lama. Please welcome Lama Rod Owen. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today. You know, we like to check in with our guests and kind of get grounded in the space. So How are you feeling today and how have you been receiving love?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for inviting me on. And, you know, as to how I'm doing today, you know, I'm feeling a lot of gratitude right now for being in the world right now. And I am really intentionally, you know, every day trying to connect to the care that I'm receiving, you know, just from the world around me, even from strangers to people I've known for years. And I try to survive off of that, you know. So I try to, you know, today, you know, trying to be in the world and trying to stay open. You know, which is the project that I'm engaged with every single day because it's so easy to shut down.
Yeah, most definitely. Thank you. How about the Melanated Social Work Brothers?
I am feeling glad to be connecting with y'all. I feel like it's been a while since I've been able to record a podcast with y'all. You know, the world opened up in that has really put us in a space of trying to figure out what our capacity is. So I feel really blessed to be connecting with y'all though. As I was telling y'all before we started the call, like it's really just been a practice in adapting to change in the world, you know, and just allowing the fact that I just don't have control over everything. And that's okay.
Overall, I'm good, feeling like this is a dream come true. To be in a space with you all, especially Lama Rod. Been listening to, you know, a lot of podcasts at the end of 2020 about you. So I'm just real interested just to metaphorically get my popcorn, you know, get my drink and listen to you. It's been a very up and down time for me personally, but I've been able to get some rest, do a lot of yoga, a lot of meditation. And to be present, you know, I've been working on trying to be as present as I can, given a lot of circumstances. And today I'm feeling up. So when it's up, it's up. And I'm happy to be here.
Appreciate you sharing. I think I'm noticing the power of being in community with you all in this moment and like feeling emotion, like move through me because I was feeling pretty sharp and easily agitated before we got on the call. So it's wonderful to hear about how y'all are doing and then just sharing space with you all. And I'm going to receive the love that you all are kind of putting out there in the world right now. It's actually a very beautiful thing. So thank you. Lama Rod, I'm wondering, I know I'm working my way through your audiobook right now, and I know you touch on it a little bit, but for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about your journey into mindfulness and your early experiences with anger as a Black man?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think for most of my life, I've been very spiritual, and I grew up in really a family of spiritual leaders, you know, deacons, people who were very involved in church. My mother is a United Methodist minister. My grandfather was a Baptist minister. So I was immersed in, you know, in spiritual community and religious community. As I got older, particularly in my early 20s, I really began to confront the reality of mental illness, particularly depression, right? And when I struggle with something, I have a tendency to get really expansive and open about the medicine that I'm seeking. And so I happened to be living in Boston at the time and surrounded by people practicing everything, including Buddhism, meditation. And that really influenced me, right, to lean in the direction of contemplative practice, right? And so long story short, I ended up working very closely with a psychic healer. Right. And one of her prerequisites for our work together was taking meditation seriously. Right. And so, and that was basic mindfulness. She was like, you have to start learning to steady the mind, to steady your attention. Right. Because you won't be able to actually embody the healing that you need to embody until you begin to train the mind. Right. You know, and the mind for me is the root of healing. It's the root of healing, and it's also the root of liberation, both relative liberation and liberation into the absolute, right? I mean, and hearing that, you know, from this healer, I was also very aware of my resistance because my mind wasn't really a fun place to hang out in. You know, and therefore I distracted myself doing other things, right? And I think one of the things that was really, really distracting for me was the anger, right? And of course, beneath the anger was this deep hurt, this deep heartbreak. But I didn't want to go there. I wasn't interested in that. But I kind of dwelled in the anger because the anger felt powerful for me. Right. You know, and then as a Black man in this society, I felt like the anger was armor that actually helped me to move out of this place of victimhood into a much more proactive kind of positionality in the world. Right. Like, as long as I had that anger, I could whoop anyone's ass. Right. I could cuss anyone out. You know, but, you know, I talk a lot about that, but really my primary, you know, superhuman ability was passive aggressiveness. So I wasn't actually cussing a lot of people out. I was just ignoring you, you know, which is just as violent as the expression of anger into, you know, into physical violence or verbal violence, right? That cut us deeply. My passive aggressiveness was as sharp as any blade. An eraser that I could weld, right? And that's how I protected myself. Like, I could smile at you, and in my mind, I was telling you to fuck off, you know, which was deceiving, you know. But what many of us discover is that we're just in survival mode, and we're doing the only things we know how to do to move from day to day, right? You know, we don't have the capacity or the space to think about doing something different. You know, because everything is overwhelming. And that's how my life was back then. So when I came to this hill, she was like, it's time to start meditating, right? And I was also really fortunate to be surrounded by people who took meditation seriously. You know, and that began the work.
When you were expressing anger, at least initially, would people notice because it was in that passive aggressive form? Or were you angry in silence, essentially? Yeah.
I was angry in silence, but people would notice like my nonverbals, my body expressions, right? And they would offer feedback. They would be like, oh, do you notice that, like, when you're just sitting, you have this expression on your face, like you're going to kill someone? Right. And I didn't, because I didn't have that level of awareness, you know. So that's the only way people could get in, because I was, you know, listen, I was in the running for the Oscar for best actor for, you know, the nicest Black guy, you know, in a circle of friends. You know, like, that was me. Like, I was the nice one. I was agreeable, right? I was easy to be around, right? Because that was another function of how I survived, right? And that's something that we learn, you know, as people of color, is that, like, I'm just trying to get by, right? So I'm just going to smile and agree, you know, and not try to hold everyone accountable, not trying to cuss everyone, not trying to be Malcolm X, right? And trying to educate everyone. I'm trying to get by. I'm trying to be happy. I'm trying to get that American dream thing, you know, which is all just an illusion, you know, but I was committed to that. To that performance. And therefore, I was so disconnected from the anger. My anger was so dangerous for me in a way. Yeah, I used anger, but I was also pushing it away because I knew how volatile it was and that it could rip through this whole performance and just really mess up the resources that I was gathering.
It's interesting that you mention all these things because this just seems like a lot of weight on you. Because in some cases, you can be looked at as the nice Black man, but as a Black fellow Black man, you understand that there's this stereotype of the angry Black man. So like, you know, and you mentioned survival. And I know you also mentioned peace can be used to bypass work.
That's right. So
it's interesting to be able, peace can be used to bypass work when you need to be, even have righteous anger to make progress and hold others accountable. But then it's like, how do I hold people accountable or whatever, hold myself accountable with righteous anger, but not come off as the angry Black guy, but also wear the cloak of hiding a mask of everything is together? That's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, but that's the fundamental contradiction of what many of us are doing to survive. Like, it doesn't make any sense, right? And because we're engaged in, you know, kind of etiquettes of survival that are always intention, that creates that kind of trauma that many of us are being weighed down by, right? You know, so, and that being weighed down actually creates a really volatile kind of situation for us. But we're always ready to snap, right? We're always ready to shut down. We're always ready to fall apart, right? Because it's that much weight happening, right? And that is the violence that we're consenting to. And that was the violence that I consented to back then until I began to learn something different.
You had talked about too, when you were coming to this meditation practice, that you were fortunate enough to be around other folks that were leaning into that practice as well. Like, how much of a factor do you think that played in it, in being able to find that community around that?
Oh, huge. Like, it was huge. Everyone that I knew meditated, you know, within the community that I was living in. And so they embodied what it looked like to have a regular practice, right? Because where I came from, like, I came from the South to Boston in my early 20s, like, no one meditated. I didn't know what meditation was. But when I landed in a spiritual community, and people were doing different things, but everyone was at least meditating. You know, working with the mind, right? And that just gave me an example, right? And so when I started getting interested in it, it wasn't this weird thing where people like, oh, what are you doing? You know, what's this meditation? No, it was like encouragement. It was like, oh, congratulations. Good. Like, you're doing this now, right? Yeah. You know, and I know a lot of us aren't surrounded with that level of encouragement and support. Actually, it's quite the opposite.
I mean, it can be hard to access too. I know the first time I was exposed to meditation, I was just like, oh, there's some hippie white people shit. You know what I mean? Like, and it wasn't, you know, until like being here in Oakland and having access to the East Bay Meditation Center and seeing other folks of color like doing the work, that it's like, oh, okay, like I can see myself, you know, reflected in this process.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that was a huge thing for me. I know it's a huge thing for a lot of us that we have to see people who look like us doing these things that we have traditionally aligned with white culture, you know. But early on, I tell you, early on, like, I moved very quickly through this whole thing around, well, Black people don't do that, you know, because I was like, white people tend, this is literally why I started telling myself, white people look like they're getting a lot out of this. So therefore, let me hustle over here and see what's happening. You know, and it's the same thing with therapy, because I was in therapy at the same time, you know, and I tell you what, I can tell my family anything. I can tell them I'm gay. I can tell them that I'm like non-monogamous. I can do all of that. Like, I don't have any problem. But when it came to therapy, I was like, you know, I'm going to keep my mouth shut, you know, because that's where the stigma arises. Mm-hmm. That stigma is just a part of this process of colonization, right? Mm-hmm. You know, where like there are these barriers that keep us from actually experiencing liberation in our bodies and minds, right? You know, but I had a lot of shame around therapy, you know, but I knew that I had to do it. You know, and I knew I had to do it because eventually people needed to know that Black men were doing this and had done this. And I knew that I had to normalize a lot of the things I was getting into. And quite frankly, I'd never seen Black people do anything that I was doing back then. You know, and a lot of things that I do, I still don't see a lot of Black folks in general doing. You know, but that doesn't stop me because we have to like we have to go and gather what's ours to gather, right? And exemplify what that looks like for others who need that medicine.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're all working as therapists and once upon a time or are currently involved in therapy. And part of this is doing the work, not in isolation.
Right.
And I know I'm someone who has definitely like prided myself on being able to engage in healing work, but like doing it really on my own. And then I didn't explore the benefit of like doing it with somebody else until like much later on in life. And it's invaluable, really. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're all advocates for engaging in all types of healing work, specifically therapy and being in community. And there's a few pieces I just wanted to touch on, because when you were speaking about like early experiences with like rage and anger, and kind of being like your affect being policed and like, you know, your face looks like this. I was saying about like how Black women really can't afford being fully emotive for similar stereotypes and being perceived as the angry Black woman as well. And just how like restricting that is in our current culture, where it's like Black folks in general can't be emotive because we're perceived as dangerous.
Right.
And it's just really limiting. So I know like y'all just talked about like, you know, engaging in mindfulness, engaging in meditation in community. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering like from your experience, like when you first started out here in Mass, like were you represented in those spaces?
Oh no, absolutely not. Like, you know, I was the only one in spaces. You know, when I started getting really serious and going off and doing longer, you know, 10-day retreats in different parts of the country, I was the only one in those spaces, right? But I was used to that already, right? You know, but, you know, it, and what I learned early on, you know, we talked about, you know, the stereotypes, the narratives that get laid on us, right, that we struggle with. What I realized early on was that I actually had to start owning that narrative because I had to disrupt the power that it had over me. Mm-hmm. You know, so if people were like, oh, you're an angry Black man, I was like, okay, so what does that mean now? You know, because I'm not believing in that anymore. I started believing, you know, as I moved into my practice, I have a right to my anger, right? And you have a right to your narrative. You know, no matter how violent you get, I'm not consenting to that narrative anymore. Right. You know?
Yeah. How do people respond? Right. Because it's like, you're no longer going to be in the ring. You're no longer going to engage in that rhetoric. So. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like people start erasing you, discounting you. And that's fine because people don't really have the power to erase you, you know, unless you consent to it. Unless you consent to the erasure, it's like, you can ignore me, but I'm still here.
Yeah.
I'm still functioning. I'm still loving. I'm still like surviving, right? Actually, I'm, you know, choosing to thrive, right? You know, and you'll lose people, you know, you'll confuse people, but that's not my labor. My work isn't to do your work, right? That's for you to figure out.
True.
Like your confusion with how I position myself in the world is not my problem, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, it's your problem. Just like my confusion about how other people position themselves in the world is my problem. Like, that's for me to figure out and relate to. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think a lot of us, you know, a lot of people of color, we need to figure out and get to this point where we're not doing all this extra work to make people understand us. Like, we just need to start being.
Go ahead, Josh.
My bad. I was just going to say, it's interesting that you mentioned just being the only Black person in a lot of these places. Mm-hmm. And if I recollect right, if I'm saying this name correctly, Paramahansa Yogananda, mm-hmm. he came to Boston in 1920, mm-hmm. and he was teaching a lot about yoga and meditation to mm-hmm. many white crowds. Yeah. And that wasn't given the space because of Jim Crow until 1927 in Washington, D.C. So for like almost 100 years, we've actually been had the space.
Right.
It's just been very used by whites. And my question to you also with that being said is, it's one thing to be like, you know, not being initially used to the meditation spaces. Right. How was it, you know, you said your family, all the other things you said about mm-hmm. how open you are about who you are to them. How was it when you let them know you were, you know, especially to a Black Christian Southern family like mine?
Right, right.
You're doing all that meditating and you doing all that stuff. What you doing now? Because I got in my family, the older folks, there's so much pushback, and this is like, I'm really just being present. Yeah. And I'm not praying. If I want to pray another God or whatever, because I think yoga is this other thing, I stopped explaining myself, and I just know what it's like for me. But it'd be interesting to see, coming from a similar background, how it was talking about meditation and Buddhism to a Black Southern Christian family.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, you know, that's a big project of mine, you know, and one of the things that I committed to early on was transparency. Right. You know, it's like, as I was moving deeper into this practice and getting trained to teach and everything, I told myself, you know what, I'm not going to disappear. Right. You know, and when I made a commitment to train to become a Lama, I did what I do well, which is I wrote a letter to my family, you know, like getting very clear about what was happening. Right. Being very clear that, like, I was doing this because I was tired of suffering, right? I was tired of the racism. I was tired of the trauma, right? And this is the medicine that I'm choosing. And this isn't in contradiction to what I was raised with, because I still believe in Christ. I'm still, you know, I still have my view and understanding of God, right? And I don't believe that Buddhism and meditation is the only way, right? I believe in multiple paths to absolute liberation. So I was very clear about that. I'm not giving up anything. I'm not pushing anything away. I'm adding something, to my life. And I was very, very, and still I'm very fortunate to have a mother who was extremely open-minded, like from the get-go. And my mother has been someone who I've not had to argue with or explain or drag along. Like, when I've made a decision to do something, I've explained it to her, and she's been like, okay, you know, and she's been like that from the get-go, because she told me once, she was like, you don't make bad decisions, right? You know, she was like, I've never known you to make a really, really bad decision. And so I'm going to keep trusting that, right? And now on this end of things, you know, being a best-selling author and being public and being who I am, she was like, okay, I get what you're doing. And so does a lot of my family, actually. You know, so when I came out with my last book, everyone in my family got it. All my aunts and cousins and dad, stepmom, everyone, and siblings, you know, they read it, you know, and they were like, thank you for this. You know, they may not agree. Like, that's not the kind of family that I want to be in, where everyone's just in agreement. Like, they still have their opinions, right? And they still have their beliefs, but they understand what I'm doing, and we respect what we're choosing to do. And that doesn't get in the way of family, you know, because at the beginning, they thought I was joining a cult when I decided to move to my monastery. They're like, you're joining a cult. I had some really tough conversations when I decided to do that, mm-hmm. you know, but I was blessed to be hard-headed, I'm blessed to know exactly what I need, right? And then I just remember our ancestors, right? I remember everyone who had to push through, the first ones who had to do the stuff that we take for granted now. And I remember them, and I'm like, it was harder for them to do what they were doing, you know?
One piece that I really love about your book is how you make time to bring in the people who you've learned from.
Yeah.
And it's like really done, I think, in a way that's like well-received, because I'm part of what I've learned from my brothers here is like, oh yeah, like we're just part of a continuum.
Yeah, exactly.
The stuff that I'm learning, that I've learned, that I'm bringing to offer, I didn't just make this up. I got it from people who came before.
That's right.
From other folks' wisdom I've been open enough to receive. So I love how you do that in your book. I know you mentioned like Mr. Monroe, your grandmother, Betty, your parents. And I'm just wondering like if there's like anyone you want to bring into the space today and the teaching that they offered you.
Yeah. Oh, so many people. Like, and when you're doing this work, you just exactly as you were saying, it's like, you're not just starting from zero, like you're starting from the work others have been putting in well before you, right? So my ancestors, my elders, my family, all, everyone was a part of that. There's so many people that that I can lift up. I actually want to lift up one of my elders, Kalivia, who I mentioned in the book as well. And Kalivia organized with Audre Lorde and Essex Hemphill, you know, back during that time. And one day, a couple of years ago, we were together and she looks at me and she was like, you are who we were praying for. You know, so when an elder looks at you and says, like, this is why we were working.
Yeah.
This is why we were organizing, right? This is why we were going through what we were going through to bring you into the world. Right. You know, and that it's like when an elder says that to you, at least for me, I can't explain the level of like gratitude and the level of acknowledgement and the level of responsibility that I was reminded of. It's like, no, I have an obligation, you know, because I am praying for my descendants to come into the world, and I am working so they have a platform to come onto to continue their work, just in the same way my elders and ancestors work to create platforms and foundations for me. And if you forget that, then the work is lost. And I fear that a lot of people who are just organizing, you know, who are doing a lot of spiritual work are forgetting that. And that's why I wrote those acknowledgments in that way, because like people need to understand that we are relying on the labor and the care and kindness of countless beings right now. We're the recipients of labor and care from beings that we don't even know we're getting.
Yeah.
You know, and we just have to know that. We have to know that like we're constantly being cared for by both seen and unseen beings.
Right. Right. And so it's like, it's such an honoring practice to be engaged in this wellness, to be engaged in our own self-care, because it wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for the folks before, like Audre Lorde spoke to. This is our political warfare, is being able to put the time towards our own wellness.
Exactly. And I love how she talks about care as political warfare, right? Because when I first read it, I was like, yeah, this is absolutely it. Like, because there's such opposition to caring for ourselves, right? You know, and you have to see this as warfare. Like, I have to arm myself. Like, I have to go to the front lines and get fierce about what I need and about my boundaries, right? Or I will be swallowed, you know, by the grief, by the violence, by the microaggressions and so forth, right? So it's like, I have to fight. Like, we have to fight for what we need to be well. It just doesn't come to you.
Yeah,
that's right. you know, you all are both, everyone's already talking about it, but how do you view mindfulness in relationship to activism?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to go inward in order to create the change that we need to see, because a lot of folks are, you know, in activism, they're in organizing, and they may be doing good work, right? But always there's a great potential that you're just going to recreate the violence that is left unmetabolized in your own experience. So when I came into meditation, like, it aligned with something that I already deeply felt, was that somehow my inner world creates the outer world, right? And if I'm not doing labor within my body and within my mind, then I will have a tendency to recreate the violence that's happening inside of me, right? But to, you know, when I decided to leave, like, my, you know, affinity groups and communities and go do years of retreat, I was looked at as, you know, like giving up, you know, like a sellout. They're like, why are you doing this meditation? Don't you know there's all this work to do? And I was like, yeah, I know there's work to do. Like, that's why I'm leaving. Like, everyone around me was burning themselves out. Like, they were suffering from all kinds of mental illness, primarily depression, right? And hopelessness, right? And just throwing themselves over and over into the work with no plan of care. And I began to understand that, like, if I was going to be sustainable into the future, then I actually had to devote years to this inner care, right? Because my organizing would be in vain if I wasn't transforming internally, right?
It's beautiful. And you definitely reminded me of, I think, something I've learned from Adrienne Marie Brown is that everyone has a role.
Yeah.
And in the summer of 2020, I was thinking about my own positionality in regards to being at protests, being in the front lines of protests. And that's not where I was at that time. I clicked up with these guys back in the day, and when we were in grad school and we were going to protests back then. Thinking about my own involvement, like, is centered more around engaging in healing work. And that's not necessarily at the front line clashing with, like, capitalism, I'll say that, with police, like, in that manner, who protect material conditions. It's not necessarily there. At least it wasn't then at that time. Not to say things aren't cyclical, it could be at a different time, but I just appreciate you expanding about, like the role of, like, you know, a Buddhist minister may not be on the front lines of a protest, but has a nonetheless still an invaluable role in regards to working towards liberation.
Absolutely. Right. You know, and we all have to figure out what our front line is, you know, and somewhere our front line isn't the actual physical front line of the action. Right. And I encourage people to figure out what their work is right now, because some of us are educators. Right. Like, that's our front line. Right. Some of our front lines is actually going back home to our home communities, to our families, and doing that foundational work with where we come from, which is ancestral work. You know, some of us are activists, organizers. You know, I'm a spiritual leader, spiritual teacher. So my role was to always bring people back to this essential labor of this internal work. Like, I need to work through my own trauma, my own anger, my own deep hurt in order to see the world that I most want to see, right? Because if I don't work through that, then I'll just start recreating, you know, these structures again, you know? And that's what we're needing right now. Like, everyone's, like, so external. You know, we're external because the work of being with the grief and the trauma right now is so overwhelming, right? You know, and people say, well, this is impossible to do, you know, but, you know, we have to start somewhere. In the same way that I did, I looked at my mind and said, this is too much. Like, I hated meditation, right? I could do it for a minute and then I would just run out the room. But I knew that this was important, that this was part of my basic labor of liberation, right? And so I stuck with it. And I learned how to be kinder to myself and gentler, right? I learned how to take care of myself, you know, because I had a vision of the world and I had a vision of myself. We have to put those two visions together. Like, I want to be free and the world needs to be free.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right? I appreciate you just like putting that into words too, just because I think so many people in the world are just resonate with that. You know, like I know for myself, like the way that my trauma has manifested in my body is just like so much restlessness.
Yeah.
And if I'm not in a space of like moving or distraction constantly, like for a long time to sit with myself was just like, it was too much, you know? And I think so many of us know what that feels like, but then to hear it reflected back and to know that even if it's hard to access it now in the moment, that there's a possibility for something else, that there can be a spaciousness there. Like that in and of itself, that realization feels liberatory.
Yeah. And this is why we need community, right? Like it's hard to sit by yourself and say, okay, I need to do this work. But it's easier when I start collaborating with others who have the same intention. Right. And that's how I got through. It's like, yeah, I may have been the only person of color in spaces, right? You know, particularly the only Black person, period, in spaces, but I was still with people who had similar intentions, right? And I was encouraged by that. And so, you know, for anyone who's listening, you know, I just encourage you to start like really like linking up, you know, with people with similar intentions, right? Who get what you're trying to do. Because having a really, I would say, I would use this word, antagonistic support structure isn't going to get you anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's just the conversation amongst people about how you are engaged in your wellness in a way of like holding it, not from like, you know, shame or guilt or that like people aren't doing enough to take care of themselves, but from this space of care, like we as people need to do that more, you know, to really check in on each other in this authentic way of, you know, just supporting each other.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, and that's about, you know, also holding space. It's like, we have to, really, you know, to hold space for others, we have to learn how to hold space for ourselves, right? I know people get overwhelmed. I know when we tell people, listen, you need to check in on people, you need to take care of people, and people are like, listen, like I can barely take care of myself, right? You know, but you know, we start doing what we can, you know, and we set our boundaries and we say, you know what, this is as much as I can do.
Right.
And yeah, as long as we're clear about that, that's a form of care.
Right.
You know, yeah. I can send this text to someone every couple of days, right? Just to check in. And that's all I can do. And that's fine.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that we've instituted as a collective is being able to develop a safe word with each other. And just so that like the reality is that on most days we all have our crazy busy lives, but we know that we would drop anything for each other at a moment's notice if it was at that point. But, you know, in normal day-to-day conversations, so many things go unsaid because of the assumptions of what is going on in other people's lives. And we had to be like, yo, this is our safety word. And we just put it out there and that's it. Like, we're going to show up like it's the VAS signal, you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Lama Rob, what is something that excites you about mindfulness spaces in the future?
Yeah. What excites me is the work that many of us are doing to make mindfulness inclusive, to really bring mindfulness back to liberation, away from overconsumption, away from happiness, away from comfort, these kind of neoliberal ideas, and bringing it back to like real, at least in my work, bringing it back to like abolitionist vision. Like, this is about getting free, right? This is about divesting from structures of rigidity, of structures, these carceral structures, and thinking about what freedom from inflictive emotion actually looks like, right? Freedom from inflictive emotion and that and investment in liberatory emotions like love, compassion, wisdom, right? You know, and that's exciting. That is exciting me. It excites me to see more and more young people of color engage in mindfulness and reframing the tradition, reclaiming the tradition. Mm-hmm. Right. And talking about and using mindfulness to highlight inequity and injustice and saying, you know, let's pay attention to this. Right. Let's work through this instead of just trying to be happy. You know.
Yeah, that's real. I think something I think I would have appreciated was engaging in mindfulness when I was younger.
Yeah.
So my partner right now is with the whole school mindfulness, mm-hmm. and they're placing mindfulness directors in different schools. And I think it's such a dope practice that I wish I had access to back in the day, because, you know, we had detentions and there was no processing. There's no relationship repair. It's just, there's a rupture and now you individually are going to be reprimanded. But it's like, why don't we actually explore like where some of this stuff comes from? Yeah, quick plug to the whole school mindfulness.
Absolutely.
Right. And these are things that we've seen like replicated throughout history, and we know they work. Like being here in Oakland, I feel fortunate to have sat in meditation with like Erica Huggins of the Black Panther Party. And as the director of the community school, like they would have the kids practice meditation. Like if a kid was having a difficult time regulating, they'd be like, all right, let's go out here and do this tree pose right now. Like, and that's beautiful.
Yeah. You know, Erica's one of my elders. I've known Erica for a bit. So we've done work together and, she's gotten me together so often.
Yeah, I remember I asked her once, one of the first times I met her, I was just like, yo, like, who's really like keeping that legacy alive of the work y'all were doing in schools? And like, how do we tap into that? And she was just like, just start a school. It's just that easy. Exactly. You know what I mean? And that's it. And it's like we put all these barriers up for ourselves. And it's like that's where that self-work is like allowing ourselves to see how much space there is there. It's like, you know, they had a vision and they executed it. That was it. Exactly. And like, they came at it from like a values-based approach and really, really supported the healing of so many people.
That all brings up, as far as like, I guess it's not school-wise, but institutional-wise, there's somebody that I really, y'all know me, I'm into my yoga. Dr. Chelsea Jackson Roberts.
Oh yeah, he's one of my homegirls too.
I stand to her. I want t-shirts, like trying to be the Black male version of her. And I meditate and do yoga with her all the time. I did some G-Funk yoga. She was crip walking in the class. I love it. But she has yoga art and literature at Spelman and red clay yoga. And I'm actually studying for my doctorate right now. And I think I'm in the beginning basis of what my capstone, aka dissertation, is as far as like yoga as a mindfulness practice to deal with Black men treating anxiety and depression, because in my research, I've seen that, you know, Black male life expectancy is shorter than Black women's life expectancy and white people's life expectancy. And a lot of for college age Black men, they don't really know how to engage, or they don't have any support in knowing what are healing coping mechanisms and what are unhealthy ones, and they don't have direction. So a lot of us, a lot of rappers that I've seen, athletes and stuff, we're dying at an early age. So, I hope that, roll tide, I hope that I'm able to endure the sands of doctor work to be able to get something like a Dr. Chelsea Jackson Roberts, but for Black men. Like that would be my next thing. And maybe even getting out of social work, I would probably go into more of the yoga world. So this is a very encompassing and loving conversation that we're having. I'm being really encouraged and inspired right now.
Well, that's exactly what Erica was sharing, is that like, if you want to see something happen, you have to do it. Right? You know, that's been my whole thing. It's like, if I want to see something, then I need to put the labor in to creating it, you know, in the world. I think a lot of us are losing hope because it's hard. Right. You know, that pressure, right? It's a lot to start something new. particularly something that's actually pushing against these systems of violence, like white supremacy, patriarchy, you know, and so forth, right? And that takes such a deep commitment to self, you know, to have a resiliency, actually to stand up to that, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. With that said, are you able to share something that's on the horizon for you? Any projects you have in the works?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm working on my third book. I'm calling it New Saints. So it's a new vision of sainthood. And you know, I talk about the book, and like, and it's not going to be what people expect. Actually, it's going to be a very different kind of writing, you know, for me. But this is about the inner work. Like, if you want to be good, this is what you need to do, right? And it means going into the heartbreak. It's going into the darkness, right? It's having to get curious about why we do the things that we do, right? And it's about being vulnerable. Right. You know, that's the new sainthood that we have to start emerging into. It's about, let's get vulnerable. Right. Let's get emotionally fluid. Let's start telling the truth. Right. Let's start moving through shame. Right. And then we start getting into goodness and virtue, which is complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think oftentimes folks want to not be in relationship to those hard places,
yeah.
to the messiness.
Exactly.
And there's almost like a neutral or a negative peace, because you know, it just below the surface, it's like, mm-hmm. I'm all good, but it's like, okay, you know, like, and of course I'm probably just projecting, but like, right. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I've done it. I'm doing the work. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, that's dope. Thank you so much for sharing. I think I speak for all of us and our listeners. We're all looking forward to it. And we also understand from word of mouth that the book, writing the book process can be quite taxing. So
yes,
wishing you well as you venture through that.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, we always like to ask our guests if there's something like, what have you been listening to lately? You know, mm-hmm. if you have any recommendations, anything that's speaking life into you, whether it's it can be anything. Yeah, you have mm-hmm. any recommendations, what you've been listening to?
Yeah, you know, I'm always listening to a lot of material, but what comes to mind now is I've been really, you know, revisiting the work of For Color Girls. You know, Ntozake Shange, you know, and just listening to that on audiobook and reading the book and just like really being reminded of the power of telling our stories, you know, right? And doing that in a way that's just bold and present, you know, and without shame, you know.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
How about y'all, Jesse and Josh?
I mean, I haven't been listening to much music lately. It's just all been audiobooks. I've just been listening to books lately, you know. Like I said, I was just tapping in with Derica's book, Becoming Abolitionists, which I'm really, really enjoying so far. And, you know, I try to keep a balance. I gotta balance my fiction with my nonfiction. So, so I've been listening to The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. And I've really been enjoying that, like this genre of sci-fi. Like, it feels like it opens my mind in new ways to just explore new possibilities for the world.
I've been listening probably every other day or so, mostly to Dr. Chelsea Jackson Roberts on Peloton meditation. I like her night meditations, depending on the vibe, or just, you know, an energizing meditation on Peloton. I've been listening to Everybody Relax, who's another Black male podcaster, listening to Equity Matters. I've been listening to the Hip Hop So Correct podcast. And also, like, again, I said I did some G-Funk yoga this morning. I started looking into, like, samples and, like, West Coast artists more so. I know more about the Bay, right? But L.A. is, like, you know about Snoop and Dre, but, like, do you know about DJ Quick or something like that? I've been getting into that. And then samples, like, the Ohio Players and Zapp and Roger. I love all the synthesizers and stuff. So that's what I've been really listening to lately.
Cool. I haven't honestly been listening to a whole lot of music lately. I've been watching shows instead. And so I just binged Squid Game on Netflix. And if y'all haven't seen that, it is dope. it is a great show. It is, the commentary is wonderful. It is, just check it out. Squid Game and Ted Lasso. I'll couple it with Ted Lasso. Been watching season two of that. Thank you, La Mirage, for joining us this evening and talking with us. We really enjoyed just your time, your wisdom, your presence, and look forward to your book release.
Yeah, thank you all for having me. This has been a blessing.
For sure. All right, y'all. That's it. Peace.